Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is January 19th, and I'm excited because this is one of the rare occasions that we have a real, active public school teacher joining us on the show. In fact, I think this has only happened a few times in the entire history of School Sucks Podcast. My guest today, his name is Brian Husky. He is a public school teacher in the state of New York. He has a website called School is a Choice. And he is the father of two, spoiler alert, home-educated boys. Brian is also a veteran of the Iraq War, and that experience is something that factors heavily into his story. I'm going to talk to you about that in just a minute. We are going to discuss today some of his discoveries in his 10-plus years of experience teaching, his process of coming to terms with those discoveries, and the solutions that he is working to develop. So for the first like 15 minutes or so, I have to say, I want you to really push through this whole conversation, but the first 15 minutes or so, we got off to kind of a rocky start. We had a lot of Skype connection issues. By the way, this new version of Skype that comes bundled with Windows 10, it's like they've taken all of the frustration and confusion that you would expect from a typical Apple Programs user interface, and they've somehow married it to the connection reliability of an old walkie-talkie that you just found in the snow. And it was my fault for not recognizing what it is. So just a service to you folks in the audience who use Skype, that thing that comes with Windows 10 is not what you want to be using. And most of that is covered by editing, but it was a rough start. Brian also said it was the second time he had ever been on a podcast. So it took us a while to get comfortable, but we did. And then I think we really hit a stride, and I was really happy with how things turned out. Originally, I wanted to have him on the show just to talk about the content of the website and a program that he's developed called Husky's Heroes. We're going to get into great detail about that in the show. But this man has an amazing story. About an hour before we started recording, we were just communicating by email, and he said, oh, by the way, here's a PDF of my book, The White Rose, A Soldier's Story of Love, War, and School. So with about an hour to spare, while I should have been going through the outline for our conversation, I started reading this book, and I honestly couldn't put it down. I know that's a cliche thing to say about a book, and an even silly and confusing thing to say about a digital copy of a book that you're not even actually holding. And I'm not sure if it was, you know, the emotional space that I was in or how it connected, you know, even though our stories are so different, how it connected to, you know, some of my experience or feelings about education, but I was just captivated. And just in the first couple chapters, Brian is describing his time in Iraq and some of the really horrific things that he had to experience while he was there. And these memories are kind of intercut with his story of adjustment to just a couple of years after coming home from a war zone, being a teacher in a public school, working with a largely immigrant and refugee population, many people who had actually come from, you know, the part of the world where these wars were happening. And he's somebody who, and it's rare, and I always admire it when somebody who can so easily have their identity wrapped up in that thing that they do, that their sense of purpose or their sense of worth is connected to a war or to a school. We see why there's so much protection for these kinds of institutions. We've talked about this on the show before. War is so glorified in our history because people have to glorify it. It's the only way you can make sense of it. The suffering, the loss, the destruction, the pain that it obviously causes to so many people. There has to be a higher purpose attached to that, that people have to believe to keep it going. And what I really admired is Brian was willing to question all of that, to separate his identity, his individuality from his role as a soldier. And you're going to find out in the conversation, too, it helped him bring a critical eye into the school setting. And because of that, he's been able to do some really amazing work. Just so you can see what I mean, I'd like to include a couple paragraphs from chapter one of the book, which is called The White Rose. And I feel like I should put a content warning here. This is at times a little graphic. We took over a hospital, and after a day of fighting, a man brought his son in. The son was obviously dead, maybe 7 or 8 years old. He was flopping around in his dad's arms. The father was laughing uncontrollably, manically. I'll never forget it. It happened, said an Iraqi student many years later. A man was killed a week before his wedding. His mother was laughing, too. She said it will be all right. She said her son is still alive. His fiancée runs home and changes into her wedding dress. His body is in the house. And they both danced around it, laughing, saying that he was alive, that he wasn't dead. Nobody could stop them. The mother didn't have any other family. She was dead within the month. The fiancé was sent away to a place where they send all the crazy people. When I see my students, I see crowds of little kids who begged for pencils and candy. I see the kids who walked to school until they canceled school so we could fight. I break up their desks to burn them to keep warm in December. And our sniper takes a position in an elementary school classroom. I see the boy whose leg was burned, the little limp sleeper who had guns pointed at him, and the laughing dad. I see them in my own kids. It haunts me. These kids from Iraq, as well as refugees from other places in the Middle East, Africa, Burma, and Nepal, didn't choose to have war or persecution happen to them. They didn't choose the actions of their countries or of ours. They all have their own stories, but somehow they made it here. They have an obligation to make the most out of their lives, and they know it. It's a second chance many don't get. What are they going to do with this new life they were given? I had a second chance, too. When I first got back from Iraq, I was angry. I wanted to fight 9/11 truthers, anyone critical of President Bush who had blessed us all with the opportunity to go kill bad guys and prove ourselves. Anyone critical of the war or invasion, anyone who suggested that terror isn't real or that American soldiers aren't the good guys or that they sometimes do bad things. My family has a dozen combat veterans. I saw the rubble from the Twin Towers. I put my life on the line. I was shot at, blown up, crashed up. Have you ever put your life or the life of anyone around you, both friend or foe, on the line for a belief? Not your career, not your GPA, your actual, literal life. I have. I dare you to challenge that belief. That's how I felt. So I know how people feel when I say things like, teachers aren't the most important factor in the learning process, and school resembles prison, and compulsion is violence. I get it. Just as I didn't want to look Iraq in the eye and say maybe killing people and breaking their stuff isn't the best way to spread love, peace, freedom, and democracy, no teacher wants to look their students in the eye and say maybe bribing and threatening you and your parents isn't the best way to offer an education that's effective, respectful, and caring. Teachers do care, and they do want to help students. However, one definition of culture is the way we do things around here. And our culture says to separate your children from yourself and your dangerous traditions and your medieval religions and your attitudes towards sex and your attitudes towards money and your other perverted ideals and have strangers raise them from the ages of 5 to 18. Then structure everything to incentivize these young adults to indebt themselves financially to institutions of higher learning. This indentured servitude will last for the majority of their adult life, during which time they will have fleeting moments of wondering who they are or where they fit into society. But most of the time, they'll distract themselves with touchscreens.
That'll be hard. Yeah, look straight ahead. That's the only way it's gonna be. Yes, it is gone, that's fine. Now there's no more.
Welcome to School Sucks.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I was reading an article you published on the website Being Libertarian. I think you wrote this about a year ago. It opens with the line, "Compulsory education is the front line in the fight for liberty, and it deserves as much attention as the taxation is theft argument. Compulsion in education falls into the same category as the draft and makes the statement, your body belongs to the state, and the state will do with it what they wish." And I read this and the rest of the piece, and Brian, as much as I would like to have my podcast filled with all kinds of, you know, divergent points of view, I do really feel comforted and appreciative when I encounter somebody who is smart and accomplished and thinks very, very similarly, you know, about education and politics. But what was interesting here is that the title of this piece was called A Public School Teacher's Manifesto. You were a public school teacher at the time that you wrote this.
I still am, actually.
Indeed. And you have a very interesting story. You're also a veteran of the Iraq War, which is something that factors into your book pretty heavily, The White Rose, which I know you sent me a copy of it an hour before we started to hear, just as kind of like an afterthought. And like I said, I wish I could have gotten it yesterday. I think I would have read the whole thing. I was really moved by the first two chapters that I read. But I want to talk about that background because I know there's an interesting story there. So
sure.
These are not exactly traditional attitudes for a current public school teacher to have. And I'm just interested in how they were formed.
Sure. The way that I view education, the way that I view myself and just my attitude towards the world is I like to think of myself as a seeker rather than a knower. So it's more of an attitude towards life. It's a philosophy. It's something that I think I internalized very young, but didn't articulate until kind of recently, where the whole idea is that I'm going to strive to find the truth with the understanding that I might be wrong. And I'm going to try and get as close as I can. And I'm going to test it against other, you know, other things and kind of see where I land. And as far as compulsion, like you said, it's not a typical position for a public school teacher. So I think how I arrived on that is sort of like part of my philosophy of being a seeker. It's like, okay, so we have, you can start with just the type of classes that we offer for students. These are all like top-down mandates. So the state will decide what classes you take, and then the teacher will implement those, that standard or that curriculum or whatever it is.
Right.
And so the underlying assumption, I guess you could say, is that we know what's better for you to put into your, so we know something, right? And that's, you know, the Taliban knows for sure, right? ISIS knows for sure. It's not a good attitude to have to say that you know for sure, because realistically, none of us know for sure. We have our best guess, and maybe some guesses are better than others. Definitely some best guesses are better than others, but you can't start from a position of, not only do I know what's best for you to put in your mind, but also I know what percentile down to the single percentile you're going to get on that, you know, whatever that assessment is. It's absurd. I guess I begin there. And, you know, you think about what's in a person's control. Like, ultimately, what's in your control is your mind and your thoughts. Those are the only things. Even your body can betray you at times. So if that's the one thing in our life that we control, what does it say when we propose a system that attempts to control what goes into that mind?
And kind of adjusts kids to it from a very, very early age. And we get to, you know, adulthood, and most of us don't even really remember a life that was any other way.
And this is what I mean by it's a front line, right? That's probably the biggest hurdle there, is that nobody, I know I didn't know any different when I was in school. My parents didn't know any different. Like you said, as far as it's not a typical thought that a teacher has, it's not a typical attitude that lots of people have. Of course you want to be educated. Of course you want to, you know, and the way to do that is to go to school. And everyone tells you school unlocks opportunities. And I would argue that diplomas unlock opportunities, right? Mm-hmm. And then education, you know, that's sort of the short term. And then the long term is the education. And education comes from many, it's just disingenuous to suggest that school is the only place where learning happens. And it's like, just on its face, we can argue, you know, maybe about the best method of educating or even what being educated means. But on its face, it's not a necessary thing for people to go to school to become educated.
How did you first wind up there? And like, I guess what was your transition like from the military to public school teaching? And why, I guess we're talking 12, 13 years ago. Why was that something that you thought you wanted to do at that time?
So I joined the military when I was 19. I joined the Army National Guard. I was infantry, and I was very proud. I still am proud of joining. I'm not, you know, I've been very, very clear about my position on the current wars and aggression. But, you know, at the time I was 19, I didn't have, as far as I knew, I didn't have a political identity. So I didn't do it as like a political statement. I did it because I was I didn't feel good in high school. Like, I didn't feel good about what I accomplished. I was MVP on the football team, and that was like the thing that I was most proud of. I didn't care one bit about my grades. And then I went to college really for the same reason, you know, the same idea, compulsory education. And then you go to college, and it's not, you're not compelled to go to college, but I didn't see as though that there were any other clear options. So I didn't want to go, but I didn't know what else to do. So I went, and I didn't do very well in college. I failed out at one point, and I didn't want to be a loser, right? Like, I didn't want to be a bum. And I'm like, and many members of my family were in the military, and, you know, World War II, Vietnam, the last Gulf War, all this stuff. And so, you know, I said, okay, well, this is one way where the boy can become a man. So I joined the military. And still without like a clear political identity until I went to Iraq and I came back. And then I start paying attention a little bit because that kind of felt significant. Like, I felt like I should start paying attention. Mm. My sense is that many people who first kind of get their feet wet and eventually become, you know, more libertarian-ish, if you want to call it that, maybe start off with a conservative party. And I was listening to things they had to say, and I didn't agree with everything, but it was a real block for me to get over the whole unnecessary war thing. Like, I'm like, all of the arguments against the war were sound in my mind, but still it was necessary in my mind at the time. And it was necessary because it was just literally a block. Like, I put my life on the line. Like, we killed people. Like, you can't tell me that this was not, you know, this was not justified.
Right.
It had to be justified.
Yeah, there was a real emotional attachment to it. You talk in the book about, like, wanting to fight 9/11 truthers and people who criticized George Bush. And, like, your identity is real wrapped up in all of that criticism, I bet, at that point.
And that is a huge lesson that I learned once, you know, it was very tough. But once I got to that position, that was a huge, and it's the same thing, I think, with teachers. Like, when I usually don't come out swinging like compulsion is some horrible thing or something, because it's just that block immediately. Like, no, we went into this for helping kids. Some of us have been here for 20 years, like 30 years. You can't tell me we're not helping kids. And I don't want to put people off to the argument, because I think there's a sound argument to be made about the effectiveness of, or the lack thereof of effectiveness of compulsory education. And that there are clear examples of education that is not, you know, top-down mandated, that is effective. And I want those people who are currently teachers to get involved and learn more about that. So I don't want to turn them off to it. But back to the Iraq thing, how you phrased it was exactly right. My identity was weaved into this idea that the war had to be necessary. And I think that's a problem. Like, that's the knowing thing. That's that category you're in where, like, I have the answer and you can't tell me otherwise, right? So, like, I had to seek the truth, and I had to be open to seeking the truth, and I had to accept that, hey, you know, maybe this wasn't. And the other thing is, I was good at being a soldier. I think I was anyway. Like, all the tools that you need to be an infantryman, I had. Like, I had physical fitness. I was able to shoot. I was able to act calm under pressure. I love being in, you know, like, shitty situations where it's like, mm-hmm. Those sorts of, like, I could sleep in the mud. Like, I liked that stuff. It's like Boy Scouts, but with guns. It was fun. And I even told someone that when I came back, the local reporter in the very small town I'm from, she asked me a question when I was on leave at home during Thanksgiving time. And I said, it's fun. She's like, well, I'm not going to put that down.
Right.
I'm like,
right.
Well, I mean, like, okay, fun isn't the right word, you know, taking it holistically, but the individual acts themselves of being part of a team, of working towards a common goal, of staying alive, of danger, of excitement, that kind of stuff, I would say, is, you know, you could put in the fun category.
When you detach it from the context, I guess.
When you detach it from the context, when you detach it from any, the context, and also the, how do you say it, the repercussions.
Sure.
And not just on the Iraqi people, but also, like, I could see why people go back for second and third and fourth tours. Like, I understand the connection between those things. It's not all, like, because they believe politically 100%. It's because there is a almost like drug-like quality to it. But then you have to reconcile that with the kind of damage that you're doing to yourself karmically, I think, and also to the world, like physically to the world.
So, all right, I think one of the interesting revelations is that perhaps, and tell me if I'm wrong, but your ability to think through this and question things, even though it was difficult, about your role as a soldier in the larger war, your ability to separate your identity from that and see it more objectively seems like it's one explanation why you could have been a public school teacher for a decade and also realize a lot of the problems there. Like, you were primed to do it by that military experience. Is that fair?
That's 100% accurate. And it didn't happen all at once. I went back to college. I was back in college, by the way, within a week, like probably the next day of we landed in Fort Drum. We were in Fort Drum for a week to do a bunch of briefings about, you know, don't kill yourself and don't be a drug addict. And right. We're like, all right. And then you're right. And then they send us off to the world. And the semester was like a weekend. Yeah, so I was in class like 2 days later, and which was also a weird thing. Like, I'm looking around at all these college students like I was in a war zone 2 weeks ago. And now I'm thinking, like, you know, I was about three quarters done with undergrad at that point, and I had to ask myself what I was going to do. And I thought, well, I didn't like school, but I do like learning. I do like reading. I am curious. Maybe I can become a teacher and ease the suffering of our nation's young. Right. So maybe I can do something that's fun and exciting. I had no idea what, you know, self-directed learning or unschooling was.
Right.
I knew very little about conventional school except for I went there. And I thought that, OK, I had enthusiasm, I had curiosity, and so I figured that I could go to school and I could do some fun things, and students would be excited about learning, and it won't – school sucks. I don't – you know, maybe it will suck a little bit less in my class.
And absolutely. Yep.
Right. And I think I was a little bit successful, but I did notice as the years go on that I was – even on a good year, I was successful. I was never successful with 100% of students, and there were some students that dreaded my – like didn't like my class. And I think most students liked me because I'm a reasonable person and I'm a nice guy and I have a perfectly shaped head. But besides that, like, right, I think people liked me generally. And I genuinely like them also. I very, very rarely do I actually dislike a student. I like most people. So it works out well, but there's always going to be some students that just don't want to be there and have something better to do. And there were always some students that just dreaded my class. And I knew this. And around the same time, my kids, who are 5 and 7 now, we homeschool. Around this time, my oldest was probably about 3 years old. And so we had to start thinking about what school we were going to send him to. And so we started looking at some public schools and some private schools, and we were going around in different places. And at the moment I stepped foot into a school, I got that feeling in my stomach, and I had to face it. I had to contend with it. Like, what is it exactly? Because I'm a teacher and I'm teaching, and what is it that's putting me off about this place? And I know the breaking point where it kind of opened up was my wife suggested that I watch a video. And it was a day before school started. And I'm like, all right, so this is a 3-hour video. I don't want to watch a 3-hour video the day before school starts. And it was John Taylor Gatto, and it was one of his videos. And so I watched the whole thing through, and I'm like, man, that's actually it. He's actually articulating some of this stuff. So like some of the stuff about compulsion and some of the stuff about the teacher being the expert and the student being the, you know, the empty vessel that just is supposed to take in information. It's not like that. I don't see education like that. And something that I think I had internalized and that I understood on a base level, I had never heard articulated before that. And it was something like, and I'm not sure if I thought about it like this at the time, but now how I think about it is it's definitely a journey. It might be cliche, but it's definitely a journey. And like, so when you have students or anybody in your life, like you're walking this path, and sometimes people will come and walk with you for a little while, and then they'll go away and then come back, and some people will walk longer than others, but it's all part of this journey, I guess.
Absolutely. So what phase were you at in your career? Like, what year were you at in your career when you encountered this video?
That must have been year 6 or 7.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what was it like going back to school after that?
It's tough because now I see these things. And I actually had already signed up for a program in college to be an administrator, because I said, all right, I need to, like, maybe I'll do something different. And I went into it thinking that I'll become a principal and then I can change things. And once I got to that program, it kind of doubled down on a lot of the stuff that's happening. Like, we're talking about true believers here. Like, we're not talking about seekers at all. These are people that believe in data and they believe in testing and they definitely believe in compulsion. They believe that students won't learn unless you force them to learn. They believe in the lazy teenager trope. They believe in, like, they really do believe in all of this stuff that I don't believe in. And they think that they're helping kids. And, you know, I don't want to put down people. I don't want to put down people, period. Right.
Right.
But
sure.
I've now seen it and read about it and understand that when you force, like, it's against human nature to force them to do something against their will. And many students are there against their will, but they have no idea what the alternatives are. And I think that's one of the biggest, that's kind of what my mission is now. And that's one of the biggest hurdles, is to help to bring people to an understanding, or show them as best as I can, or as best as I understand it, that you don't have to force people to learn for them to learn, and that it's not an effective way to do it. And recently, someone criticized unschooling. Mm-hmm. It was actually on Twitter, I think. And he said, well, it sounds all fine and good, but then if you really dig deeper, it's just, you know, it's glorified Montessori. I think he said something like that. It's a glorified Montessori. And I said, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm not sure exactly what he means by that, but if that's the case, then so what? Like, if you leave people alone and their natural inclination is to go towards some topic and to engage in that topic in a mixed age setting until completion, which is how I very, very generally understand a Montessori system to be, then what's wrong with that? Even if we say unschooling isn't, like, always this paradise where people live, where they just, you know, where their parents don't tell them to brush their teeth and they just brush their teeth on their own, and they run around wild barefoot and they learn math somehow that way. Like, even if it doesn't look like that, even if it looks like, you know, kids taking up an interest and working towards that interest and digging deep into it, and then, like, or just quitting it, either way, like, What if it does look like that? What's the problem exactly?
It's letting young adults learn like adults learn, right? Like, if an adult Sure. wants to learn something, they go out, they take charge, and they figure out what they need to, you know, gain some understanding or even mastery over that subject. And I think what's super frustrating about being a teenager is that they can see the light at the end of the tunnel. They can see adulthood. In many ways, by the time somebody's 16 years old, they can drive a car, they can have a job, they can have a girlfriend, and they're still being managed with the teaching and routines of their childhood, and they're still being supervised in the same ways. It's a real producer of resentment. I mean, that was the case for me when I was a teenager. Not that I thought I was ready for real responsibility, or that, you know, I knew what I should do, or I knew who I wanted to be, but I just didn't really care for all of the strictures that made me continue to feel like a child. And I had the same experience when I was a teacher with teenagers.
Sure. And I bet you were ready for more responsibility than you thought you were.
Absolutely. But how would I have known that?
Right.
I mean, in that environment.
There's no way you would have. And we have, and, you know, students still have to ask to use a bathroom. To me, it's egregious. It's a violation of their dignity. I had a student come and ask me to borrow a pair of, from a different class, come ask me for a pair of scissors because a teacher wouldn't let them use the scissors because they're too, like, this whole, like, making people who are basically adults, like young adults, but adults, inexperienced adults, but still adults, act like little kids is baffling to me. And it's, and, you know, nothing good is going to come from it.
No, I agree. And I think it puts people in a really difficult position when they get into higher education. We're seeing this all over the news and all over social media, where people who've gone through 15,000 hours of government school are now in some of the most elite universities in the country, and they can't even handle adult conversations. You know,
sure.
I mean, I would say that's certainly one consequence. But Brian, I wanted to ask you, because your story is a lot like mine. I went into education with a very idealistic vision. I even was pursuing lateral to my early teaching an administrator's master's degree, educational leadership, I think was the name of the program
right.
that I was
yep,
in.
Yep, that's the degree I have.
Yep. You know, so I taught in a boarding school from 2002 to 2004, while I was doing this, I was in the master's program, and I was surrounded by public school teachers, both from New York. So I learned a lot about the school politics there. It was in North Adams, Massachusetts, which isn't too far away from where you are. Yeah.
Sure.
And the other teachers were from, the western part of Massachusetts. So these were people who were showing me my future. And all they did was, in their first 5 years of their career, demonstrate that the idealism had been sucked out of them, that they were super frustrated with the lack of control they had over what they were doing, even though they had a lot of energy and a lot of desire to help young people. And I wound up just pursuing a different path as far as my career went. I mean, that ruined. I wanted to be a public school history teacher and then a public school principal. Those were my goals for life. Sure. 14 years ago. But you've had a lot of the same realizations that I had, and you've persisted. And I wonder how you're able to do that. Like, what helps you continue to do this job?
Well, it's where, I guess two things. First of all, it's where students are by and large, right? So I really enjoy working with this age group. I am able to experiment a bit, more so in previous years, but I'm able to experiment a bit because, administrators don't come in very often, first of all, right? They come in like 3 times a year. So I can try different things and gear it towards, and students, I think, really do appreciate that. Like, I give them more freedom to pursue different things. I'm not, if people are familiar with the legend of John Gatto about how he let eighth graders go on internships and ride alongs with truck drivers and stuff. I haven't gotten to that quite that level. Yeah, I haven't figured out how to work that yet. But I do give them plenty of opportunities, as far as I can tell, to read the things they want to read and write about the things they want to write about. And, I see myself as a resource and for people of that age. And I just love working with people who, like you said, are like adults, but not quite yet. This is a critical part of your life where in a year or something, you might make a decision that changes your life forever, like student loans specifically. You might. And just these ideas of you have agency, like you actually, because they believe they're in this fish water. They really do believe that they have to wait for permission to go use a bathroom. Like, just kind of extrapolate that to something larger. Like, they have to wait for permission to live their lives. You don't. I love being able to talk to kids about these things. And this is where the kids are. I say that's the one reason. Another reason is also my current, I just got transferred this year. So I'm at a different school, and the school is 100% English language learners, and they're at a very low level of English. And I've taught the more advanced version of this demographic for many years now. But this is my first year with them, and I will say that I'm not backtracking over. I am against compulsion, but I think if it were a free system, that many of these students would opt for a system similar to what we have now, because they don't have anyone at home that speaks English. They don't have a lot of resources, and that's what they want to do, is learn English. So they're there willingly because this is the place where they go to learn English. So I'm able to work with kids who want to be there, who like technically aren't choosing to be there, but that's not even true. A lot of them are choosing to be there because a lot of them are 18, 19, 20, even 21 years old, and they don't have to come to school. They're coming to school because they want to, and they want to learn English. So it's not that I'm necessarily anti-school specifically, although there are plenty of things that we could, that we could nitpick, not even nitpick, but plenty of things that are ineffective about them. This is a group that, if given the choice to choose, they would choose something similar, very similar to this system. So, it feels good being able to help them to the extent that I can.
That was always one of the things that was a check for me, as far as my attitude forming around compulsory schooling, being influenced by people like Gatto, being influenced by, Murray Rothbard's chapter on education in For a New Liberty, and, several offshoots of that kind of libertarian message. I had to remember that I worked with a population of kids who didn't really have many options, and because of some of the home lives that they had to endure, school was actually a kind of respite. And it made me, in the whole kind of push a button scenario, like push a button and this system disappears tomorrow.
Sure.
With all the bad things about the public school system, whenever that question is put to me, I do see those people who are in a situation where that's actually a better option for them during the day than what life is like in the rest of their lives, either at home or in their neighborhoods. And it's a problem. It's a hard thing to address.
Right, sure. And I was reading I was watching a video, I think, recently about a guy who opened some boarding schools in India for poor kids, only for poor kids. And I'm thinking, you know, part of me is like, there's something icky about, you know, pulling kids away from their parents and separating them and putting them in boarding schools. But another part of me is like, you know, poverty in India is poverty. So like, to be able to give them an opportunity to be able to maybe learn English, maybe learn some rudimentary skills where they might, you know, they might find something that benefits them. It's that whole knowing and seeking thing. I think it's even when I describe myself as libertarian, but I even sometimes hesitate to do that because I don't want to. It's not that I believe these things because I'm libertarian. I can be described as libertarian because I believe these things.
Sure.
So it's not that I'm anti-school necessarily. I'm anti people not taking control of their own lives and making decisions for themselves as to what they put into their brain.
Exactly. And I think that brings us to one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about today. You actually set up where you are a kind of self-directed learning program that you called Huskies Heroes. And I think, we talked before the show, and at this point, it seems like it's run into some logistical problems. It's a hard thing, I think, to sure. set up and run lateral to the public school system. But I was really encouraged by the idea, and I just wanted you to take a few minutes to share the program and the principles with my audience.
Right. So Huskies Heroes was a program. We're failing up. All right. So it's not manifesting itself in a physical setting right now. I'm going to put it online and we're going to try and work different angles. But essentially what it is, man, working at school, there's a lot of kids who I could point to and pick out and say, hey, you know, this program would be better for you. You would be happier. You would learn more. It would be more beneficial to you in the long run. And that's how I approached it. Like, what kind of program would I have wanted to go through as a teenager? What kind of program would be good for many of these students that just don't fit the mold or are bored most of the day at school or just don't. So that was my take on it. And I said, all right, so I wanted something that was light. Like, not, I didn't want to start a whole new school, right? Mm-hmm. I want like a program where students could register as homeschooling and that they could withdraw from school and they could enter into the program. Now, I think the number one challenge with starting something like that is, there's two types of people you're going to get. You're going to get people unhappy with school and you're going to get current homeschoolers. And current homeschoolers, especially once they get to be teenagers, they've kind of figured out that you don't need someone else to do this. Like, education is something that you can and maybe even should do, not on your own, but without like a structured program. And then convincing, you know, kids, and I wasn't advertising in school. I'm not going to do that because they pay my bills and I'm not going to.
Right, right.
I'm not going to try and encourage kids to drop out of school while I'm working at school. but trying to get the word out and trying to explain to people what it is who are already in the system, there's a lot, and I understand it too. There's a lot of anxiety behind that. And they're like, well, you know, my son or daughter is struggling and they're not happy, but that's a big leap for us to take. And I'm whispering, no, it's not that big. You can do it. But it's, you know, that remains the largest challenge. But the program itself is set up kind of like a Socratic seminar. It's set up almost like what we're doing now, honestly, where we sit in a circle and we have some kind of topics or maybe a short video or an article or some talking points and we just hash stuff out. And it's like, we don't, like, I come into it like I'm a bit older and maybe I know some more stuff, but I don't have the answers and you don't have the answers. And let's talk through this and let's also be open with each other and let's not be afraid of necessarily offending one another or saying something that's wrong or embarrassing ourselves. It's just like, let's be like Socrates here and just talk it out.
I think that the way it's organized on your website is interesting, and it looks like the program breaks down into about six attributes. And I was wondering if we could just go through them and talk about each one a little bit, because it produces a very kind of, along with what you're already saying, this looks like a very holistic education. So I'm just going to list them really quickly, and then we'll go through them one by one.
Okay.
Junto, which was a concept that Ben Franklin, I think, introduced to the American language. Service to the community, personal projects, the teaching of rhetoric in the form of writing and speaking, recreational activity, and the availability of academic transcripts. And I mention that last one because one of the great challenges has been with alternative education credentialing. But because you have the credentials as a teacher, you're able to offer that, which I thought was, it's not entirely unique, but there's, I know of a lot of people who are moving away or outside of traditional schooling, whether it's secondary school or higher education, and they're really searching for a way to offer this. So first of all, I think it's amazing that you were willing to make this commitment to invest this time on top of what you already have to do every week. You know, you're also a husband and a father. But this really looked like an amazing program. So I just wanted to talk about each one of these. Why don't we start with the Junto?
Sure. So Junto is like you said, if you read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, which I recommend everybody does, he's a superhero, and he talks about how when he was 21 years old, he invited people who were older than him and more, I don't want to say more intelligent, but maybe more experienced and more well-read than him, but he still led them in exactly what I was describing before, where they would meet, I forget now, every other week or once a week or something in the house, and they would bring each of them would take turns to bring an original essay and read and discuss that. And then they would have like talking points. And so, discuss something about morality or politics, debate in a sincere spirit of inquiry after the truth. That's that seeking and not knowing kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Talk about things that you were rejected in, talk about things that you were successful in. Is there anyone we can help? Is there anything in the society that we can do? Is there anything in the local community where we could help, where we could be helpful? Like those sorts of clubs that are geared towards self-improvement and mutual improvement and improvement of society. That book club kind of thing where people just get together and talk about how are we going to improve ourselves? How are we going to improve the community? And I think that in and of itself is a really good basis for a solid education for a young adult who's looking for responsibility.
Absolutely. And how did you apply that to the program?
Well, it would always be it was a 3-hour program, and we would come in and it would be the first hour of the program, and they would sit down, and we had a list of those kinds of prompts that I modified from Benjamin Franklin's book. And I just opened it up to whatever kind of thoughts it depended. If they had an essay to read, we did that first, and then we discussed their essay. And then after that, I would just kind of open it up. And then, are there any questions on here that jump out at you? Is there anything that's on your mind? Always geared towards mutual improvement and improvement of, people around you.
Indeed. Let's talk about the second one, service to the community. And one of the reasons why I like this is because obviously we live in this world of incredible digital connection. And I think at this point, it's undeniable and even kind of passe to point out that leads to, because many of us weren't prepared for this, and many others weren't able to effectively prepare their children for the realities of today's world, it's led to a form of interpersonal disconnection. And that certainly is very apparent in small communities everywhere. People just, see their surroundings as what they have to pass on one place to the next, but they don't really see it as a whole community. I've realized this spending time, in the town that I grew up in, how connected everybody used to be. And now, some of these same people who are part of that connection don't even know their next door neighbors in a condominium complex. So why was that important for you as an attribute of this program?
Well, yeah, and I say the same thing. Working with immigrants, most of them have their own communities, and it's man, it's just feels good to be useful, and feels good to be helpful. And it's something that, like you said, that we're missing in society. Today I was at work. At the end of the day, there was an assembly. The whole school is, now that I was transferred to this school, it's a very small school, all international kids. And they were doing there was five or six of them doing a presentation on Martin Luther King. And they were doing their version of I Have a Dream speech. So many of them were like, you know, I have a dream about Afghanistan, women will be equal, that sort of thing. And there was a girl up there from Afghanistan who was having a hard time. I mean, they're really just learning English, and she's having a hard time reading. And one of the other girls, who's a little bit more advanced than her, came up next to her and was like helping her and like helping read along with her. And it was like, we just have this natural urge to want to be helpful to our fellow neighbor, but we don't have the opportunity, or we don't seize the opportunity to do that. And I wanted to encourage that, and I wanted to build that into the structure. I talk about self-directed learning and the problems with compulsion, and then I turn around and I make a curriculum. But I'm like thinking this through as to, okay, if there is to be a curriculum that is loose enough where people can follow their own inclinations or their own bends, but is structured in a way that also appeals to young people, that maximizes their potential. And part of that, I think, is definitely finding a place where you feel useful and you feel good and you feel like you have some responsibility, you're connected. I don't know if you've read the book Tribe. I finished it just kind of recently.
I haven't.
Sebastian Younger, man, that's a book you want to check out. It's he talks about this kind of stuff, about what I was talking about kind of earlier about the infantry platoon and how you're like the feelings of connection. Well, it's the same thing. I imagine, I don't have this experience, but it's the same thing with first generation communities coming over from different countries. Like they have this connection where they rely on each other, and it feels good to rely on each other. When it's voluntary, when you choose to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, I really think it helps, like just from my own observations with, you know, how children are brought up. You know, there was no such thing as daycare when I was little. We had play groups where, you know, the trusted friend of my mother would take a turn with, you know, four or five of us on a Wednesday afternoon if everybody else wanted to go to the grocery store or to the mall or whatever. And, you know, that was how we interacted. And that was like a really, really important, and just like the there's the safety aspect and there's the belonging aspect. And I think there's a certain kind of identity aspect, even though I wouldn't want that to subtract from individual identity. But there's lots of really, really important things that I think you and I were fortunate enough to, you know, have access to when we were growing up, that I just worry so many kids today. I mean, I see it with my nieces and nephews. It's just, it's almost foreign to them.
Sure. You want to belong to something bigger than yourself. And if you're living only for yourself, then you're going to have anxiety. So many of us are taking medication, right? So many kids are taking medication. And I don't believe that all of it, listen, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not going to recommend anyone come on or go off of medication, but I can't believe that all these people who say that they're anxious or anxious, like clinically anxious, like clinically depressed, like you don't belong to anything significant that's bigger than yourself that you had some say in either. Like, and we have to draw a distinction here too. I think there needs to be an element of consent. And when you're younger, maybe that is you just go along with mom and dad and you see what they do. And then when you're older, you say, okay, well, I like working with animals, so I'm going to go volunteer at the animal shelter, and I'm going to meet other people that work with animals, and I'm going to kind of decide whether I like it or I don't like it. But so I don't want to make it sound like, because this is what happens, is that I say something like this and, you know, some superintendent hears it, and next thing you know, like all the kids have to go to the animal shelter and all the kids have to volunteer
exactly,
10 hours a week.
Exactly.
And, right.
Exactly.
Like it kind of misses the point.
That's the great thing about, you know, a voluntary community and modeling, you know, wanting to be part of a community. Like when the school does it, the compulsion of school is just a handle that you can put on a bunch of people and move them around all at once for the sake of efficiency. You know, communities aren't like that. I mean, there was a lot of discord in the community that I grew up in, politically, like issues over the school. I remember my dad was the chairman of the school board. But what was prioritized about that was, hey, we all live in the same town. You know, the baseball field has to get mowed, like those kinds of things. Yeah. So it doesn't mean there wasn't a space for individuality. but there was something that was kind of keeping everybody there together. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized that that was something that was special. And, you know, this second attribute that we've been talking about, community, is actually very complementary to another attribute of the program, which you listed as personal projects, which I'm guessing are self-directed, individually chosen. One student would be working on something different from all of the others. But the community, and I want you to talk about that in more detail, but what's helpful, especially I think in a self-directed education environment, is that there's a kind of accountability for what's being learned.
Right. Well, you have an accountability to yourself, first of all, because you're gonna be bored otherwise. Like, that's the whole,
right.
they're gonna learn, you know, they're not gonna learn unless you force them to learn. Well, that's actually not true. Or, you know, maybe the argument is they're not going to learn the right things unless you force them to learn the correct things. But then you get, you know, you come back to, well, who the hell are you to say what's right and what's wrong? Like, you're the one you see the future. Like, if that were the case, then maybe all of us who are teaching can just be, you know, maybe we should all run for office, and then, you know, right? Like, if we have all the answers, let's just do that. Yeah. So yeah, you have this accountability piece. The personal projects, realistically, you could also count service to the community as a type of project. But what was ironic to me was that when I was in my grad program, my education leadership program, this is how they ran the internship. And I thought it was really good, actually. They had a list of like 100 different projects you could do, and we had to accumulate 600 hours altogether. And so they had a list of things you could do, but then they also said you can propose anything you want, and then your advisor just approves it, and they always did. Mm-hmm. And I did a bunch of like self-directed, like I think I counted, I can't remember now, but I might have even counted that article for being libertarian. I might have counted the work I did on that as part of my hours. Like, I was doing literally whatever I wanted. And what I wanted to do was look more at alternative education. I visited some, like the Albany Free School. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So I went and visited them, and I was able to observe some classrooms, and like, I did stuff like that. And I'm thinking, man, like, they're teaching us how to be administrators, and they see this as a quality education. Why can't we do something like this in school? Right. Or maybe that's how I set my program. So that's how I set the program up, is that, okay, so you'll have some things that you'll complete, and then you'll talk about them and write about them, and you'll have something that is tangible, right? Something that you completed, some product or something. And it'll be like, I don't know. It's a little bit idealistic, but it, to me, it's more active than it is passive. It's, you're actually doing something rather than receiving something. And I guess I'll also say that, like, sitting for a lecture isn't so bad either. TED Talks are wildly popular for a reason. It's just that when they're, it always comes back to compulsion. It's like, so I watched a TED Talk, and it was really interesting to me, and it somehow, why was it interesting? Well, it connected with me on some level, and it changed the way that I looked at things, and it changed the way that I led my life, or it changed maybe even the smallest part of me. Same thing with podcasts. Podcasts are very popular, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing wrong, like when you're in teacher circles and you're talking about pedagogy and things like that, and they talk about the sage on the stage and don't lecture, and you want to put them in groups and you want to move them around and you want to keep them active, and it's like, well, that's maybe true in one sense, but in another sense, there's nothing wrong with lectures in and of themselves. People pay lots of money for lectures, like lots of money. So it's not the fact that it's a lecture that's boring. It's the fact that they didn't choose to, like, they're listening to something that they never chose to do. So so personal projects fall into sort of that kind of category. You can, you know, listen to a lecture, listen to a podcast or something, but also actually produce something, like make something, build something, read something, like read a book, or read 10 books, or read 100 books, set a goal and attempt the goal. And if you complete it, then awesome. And if you don't, let's talk about it.
Absolutely. And one of the most moving experiences and educational experiences that I had as a teacher, it was the 2002-2003 school year versus the 2003-2004 school year. And I was the lead teacher of this specialized by a certain type of behavior campus at a boarding school in Vermont. In fact, the place, I used to avoid saying the name of the place because I wanted to be more anonymous, but it wound up getting shut down and facing all kinds of legal problems. So it was called the Bennington School. I mean, you're close enough that maybe you've heard of it.
Sure.
Okay.
It's in Bennington.
It's in Bennington, and I grew up right over there.
I grew up in Petersburg, New York.
Yep. So that was where I went to college. That was where I worked. Early in my career, I was there until, you know, the summer of 2004. And in those 2 years that I worked at that campus, the first year I wanted to be good, right? I wanted to be good as far as the machinery of the school was concerned. And it was my job to run an orderly classroom and keep all the kids inside it and to do the thing that I thought at that point was education, which, based on everything I had ever learned, was school. Giving kids assignments, giving kids worksheets. And so I tried to run for a year. I tried to write lesson plans with kids who had, you know, all kinds of really, really difficult emotional challenges. They had been abused. They were, you know, heavily medicated, which in many ways affected their behavior or their attention or their energy. So there were all kinds of obstacles to running what I thought was a normal classroom setting. But I tried it for a year because I wanted to be good, and that's what I thought I was supposed to do. I was 24 years old, and I was there to please the authorities so I could move up in that school to a better position. That was why I took the job. It was such a catastrophic failure that I thought I was going to die. Like a young man, healthy, you know, worked out, ate well. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. It was so stressful. And the next year, I'd like to tell this story as if I had some kind of vision, but at the time it was really just resignation. I said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to start a newspaper for the school. Everybody in the class, there were 10 regular kids in the class. I said, you can all pick your jobs. And three kids wanted to do the same thing, so I had to figure out how that was going to work. But they all did the thing they wanted to do. We produced a real product that they were proud of, that they got a lot of appreciation from, you know, the rest of the school, where even they were kind of exiled on this separate campus because of some of their severe behavior issues. But it was night and day with almost the exact same population of kids. So, like I said, I'd love to tell that story as if it was all part of the plan, but it was really the genesis of that idea was pure exhaustion and spending the summer of 2003 dreading going back to that classroom and searching for a way for me to survive, you know, another year in that setting. And it was about making it self-directed, about giving individuals, without knowing any of the stuff that I know, giving individuals control over what they do every day and producing something real that was what made such a dramatic change in that environment.
Just basic, I mean, that's just basic respect too. Like, you're respecting the individual for as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, absolutely. And that's a great story, and that really does. And you look at teachers who are 20 or 30 years in who are the most burned out. Those are the teachers who every single year are fighting what they think is a good fight of this, you know, the curriculum and the rules and everything else. It's very exhausting trying to get people to do things they don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's terribly exhausting. And the teachers that haven't figured out that you have to bend a little or bend a lot are the ones who are so burned out after, you know, probably after only a few years. And then the ones that have been there for 30 years, you just keep sticking it out. It's like Gollum, right? That's how I kind of equate it. Like, you held that ring of power for too long.
Mm.
Yeah, I 100% I agree with you.
You know, the other thing, too, you mentioned this earlier in the conversation. I always thought this was a part of it, too. When I was in school learning to be a teacher, it was very warm and fuzzy, and it was a lot of, you know, constructivism. Like, the people who were teaching me to be a teacher, they talked like proponents of the Montessori school or the Sudbury people. Like, that's how they talked.
Sure.
You know, they taught us about constructivism and the student-centered model of education. And then at the end, it was like, okay, go have fun trying to insert this into the machinery, into the factory of the public school system. You know, all this idealism, it just didn't work. And it really kind of sucked the life out of me and I think a lot of other people pretty quickly.
As best as I can tell, the standards in New York suggest that you can do, like, students can choose anything that they want to choose to do, so long as what they're choosing are the thing. Like, the whole idea is that here are the things you have to teach, get students to choose them. It doesn't make sense. That, like, if you look at the rubric for grading we have rubrics for our teacher evaluations. And if you look all the way on the right-hand side where you get the maximum points, it's that students, like, come willingly or choose to do the activities. And it's like, well, the activities that you're making them do, you have to find a way for them to choose that. It's like,
oh, this is even talked about, like, in child psychology or, like, behavior management of children. Create the illusion of a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something, and it's tough to sort of explain. When I went to grad school to be a teacher, I didn't know much about teaching or schools or any of that, and I was kind of going into it blind, but I had a similar scenario. But to be honest with you, when I was in grad school, I was the one arguing for the SATs and arguing for like sort of homogeneous testing, because in my mind, not having a whole lot of experience, I thought that would be the most fair way, because now you're comparing apples to apples and you're like, okay, so if this person gets a test and this person gets a test, then at least there's some equity there. And what I failed to realize, or what I failed to kind of understand, was two things, really, is that, first of all, the connection between how well you do on a test and your ability to actually perform is non-existent. And secondly, you know, you're compelling them to do something against their will, which is, I would argue, unethical, but definitely ineffective.
Right. Yeah. So I spent the latter part of my career doing almost exclusively standardized test tutoring, like the SAT. And I could argue for it just on the grounds that it does something that, if people embrace the opportunity of it, it does something that school really doesn't do a very good job of for a lot of people. And that's teaching critical thinking skills. You know, teaching, you know, how to build a vocabulary based on root words. I mean, you teach English and you might do that in your class, but it was a foreign concept to me that I could figure out the meanings of vocabulary words in English by knowing Latin roots. I found that out when I was like 25, you know, and maybe I hear a lot of these stories about, you know, I have a lot of really bright friends and, you know, they always knew they were geniuses, but shit, I didn't.
Right.
I remember, like, how old was I when I started doing that? 27, maybe, when I started working for this company in Massachusetts. I was just like, this test is a goldmine of learning opportunities. And it was always just something that I dreaded. And I actually tried to package that when I would try to sell the program eventually went on and started a company doing this. And I would try to package that as, like, this is the missing opportunity. This is, like, the missing piece that school didn't provide. But, you know, the opportunity is in the studying, right? It's not necessarily in those two numbers. And I agree with the larger part of what you're saying, is that it's not perfectly reflective of a person's abilities. Because, again, it's putting people in that circle and acting like, you know, there's choice or freedom inside it. It's like, this is a very specific type of test, testing very specific aptitudes. And in the end, you know, when we took it, it translated to two numbers. Now it translates to three that go onto, you know, a college application. And that doesn't tell a whole story.
Right. And there is also something, like, learning is if we think of it as a journey, it's a social and emotional journey also. And if you are not that type of person who's going to do well on the test, or if you don't have the resources to hire someone to tutor you, or you don't have the people at home, or you don't speak English, it's you're going to see those numbers that you're talking about, and you're going to feel like it's just going to be another thing that communicates to you that you aren't good enough. And and it's, you know, it puts people in the wrong state of mind. I think it's the same. I have the same criticism about special education. A lot of times these meetings turn into, like, it reminds me of, like, this the sorority thing where they stand in their underwear and you circle their problem areas, like that like that kind of thing, where we just talk about, you're a little bit low here and you're pretty low here, but we're going to teach you how to ride the bus. And it's like, come on, like, they can do more than that. Like, you can expect more from them. Just because they're not passing algebra doesn't mean that they're an idiot. Like, don't talk to them like they're an idiot. This girl can ride the bus. Like, come on. Like, I don't know. I just, when you start talking about the process of running a school, or, like, the logistics of it, it's almost inevitable that you're going to start looking at grades and data and points. And then you start getting into this mindset where you're where you're the chess player just moving the pieces on the board and forgetting that there's an actual human being that's moving along with those pieces.
Absolutely. Well said. So before we run out of time, let's skip through the last three attributes that I listed for Husky's heroes. The next one, which I think is a really underdeveloped skill as far as public school goes, rhetoric, in the form of writing and speaking. And, you know, this kind of serves the one we were talking about before, you know, personal projects, because after you go through taking all the pieces of a new pursuit of knowledge and putting them together in a logical and orderly way, there is the question of, you know, how do we communicate this? How do we share this? How do we make it useful? And that's what the communication is all about. So how did that show up in the program?
And it's so important. And so I had two students, and one student was a lifelong homeschooler, and the other student was really, really suffering in public school. And she, she told me that she had a hard time going into the store and buying a soda. Like, she couldn't talk to the cashier. It was bad. And I'm telling her, listen, this is, first of all, that's normal. You're supposed to be a little bit like, that's kind of extreme, but you're supposed to be a little bit nervous. It's not, you know, speaking in front of people, you know, if you think about it just from an evolutionary standpoint, this is what I told her, by the way, I have no idea if it's true, but it says, speaking of it from an evolutionary standpoint, like, the humans that were a little bit nervous about something were the ones who survived, and the ones that were not nervous about anything at all just jumped right in the fire, and that was it. And so I'm like, it's natural to be a little bit nervous in an unusual or an a different situation. There are no lines here, so you can speak to the cashier, you can speak to me, you can speak in front of people. So we sort of just worked those muscles out. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I was a little nervous before you called, right? I was nervous when I was at the other podcast. I was nervous when I was on I was on the news a couple times for a couple of different things I was doing at school, and I was nervous for that. And you're going, and the kids that I saw today who barely speak English, who spoke in front of the entire school, they were very nervous. But it's something that you know, it's a muscle that you have to exercise, and you don't build muscle by lifting light weights. You have to lift heavy weights.
Right. Exactly. And it's funny, because I think you sounded nervous at the beginning of this podcast. I bet I probably did too. I've done 500 and something of these, and I think I still sound nervous at the beginning of most interviews. But it's funny how quickly that works itself out just by the doing of it, because neither one of us are nervous now. I feel great now, you know?
Yeah.
And I always used to feel that way when I was put in those situations, like dreading, like sitting, waiting to get up and talk in front of people. And then every time I did it, as soon as I was at the podium, like 30 seconds in, 1 minute in, I was just like, oh, this is fine. This is great.
Interviews are the same way, public speech, all of that kind of thing. And then writing is more of a process. I personally enjoy writing better because you can delete the stupid stuff you say, right? As opposed to speaking. But writing is the same kind of thing. Like, you have to mean what you say, you have to be genuine, but you have to also write it in such a way that appeals to people where they're going to want to read it. Because when you're writing in school, you don't really have to, the most genuine opportunity you have for writing in school, in my experience anyway, is when you're writing your college essay. And I think that's actually a very powerful thing, but it's also a very revealing thing to most students, because when they sit down to write their, Common App or their college essay, they discover that they haven't done any, like, it's very, the only people that can really write a stellar Common App are the people that came here from another country, because either they're fleeing war and something very big happened, or just the act of coming here is a very big thing, or it's people who had some tragedy happen to them in their life, which I don't wish on anybody, but if they had one, they could talk about that and what they learned from it. Everyone else is talking about their AP classes and how they played, how they played volleyball for a year or something.
It was one of the most difficult things to do. I used to work as a college consultant, like when I was doing the SAT tutoring, because obviously those two things are hand in hand.
Right.
And man, extracting stories, I felt bad because it was my job and I was supposed to be good at it, but like extracting meaningful stories for those essays from, you know, somebody who's 16 or 17 years old was really a challenge in most cases. I mean, I was in like the suburbs of Boston where, you know, a lot of people had pretty comfortable lives. So certainly none of the problems or the issues that you're describing. It was confronting for me as a consultant dealing with that. Yeah.
Well, they have to get out there and fail at something. That's the thing. They're not really doing that. And they come in, they do exactly what they're supposed to do, right? Quote unquote, exactly what they're told to do, but they don't it's that whole the weightlifting metaphor, I guess. It's like you don't get strong by pushing against light weights. You have to go, you have to get out there. You have to take initiative.
Exactly. The final piece that I want to talk about, because I thought it was interesting and I'm guessing that it was fairly trying, was setting up a system where you could offer, I guess, to colleges academic transcripts, which is one of the most attractive things as far as like inserting something like this, which is a program that I really like and I really think could have a lot of benefits to a lot of people who are struggling through the school process as an alternative. That is a great doorway, right? Because you're not just using a phrase like unschooling. You're saying, look, we'll create a self-directed alternative, but if you want to stay on the same direction you're already going, we can give you, you know, a pathway to college if you think that's important. And college is a whole separate show. You know, the value of college is a whole separate show for us, but as far as making this a viable alternative to compulsory school, this is a very, very important piece of the puzzle. And I was just wondering what the process was or what the difficulties were that you encountered.
Right. I did a bunch of research first, and I contacted colleges. I contacted local colleges. I contacted, more elite. MIT is really big on this. The way New York State is, I can't, as a program, I can't offer a high school diploma, but I could, but anyone can write transcripts. The cool thing is, literally anyone can write transcripts. I didn't know that. The other cool thing is, there's no law, at least in New York State, I don't know about everywhere, but there's no like law or regulation or rule that says a kid has to have a high school diploma to go to college.
Right.
So like, and if you think about it logically, yeah, well, that makes sense because you have international students. And so what, you're going to take their diploma from whatever country they're from? That's not the same as here. So it's, and then you do have some homeschooling kids, and then homeschool is becoming more and more normalized. And so you have more and more of those types of students. And so, yeah, so they don't need, most colleges would like a high school diploma or the equivalency, but they don't need it. As smaller the college, here's the catch 22 though. The smaller the college, usually the more expensive the college, but the smaller the college also, the more likely they are to look at those qualitative aspects, the narrative transcripts instead of just looking at the data and the numbers. Now you are going to, it really depends on the college, but many times you're going to have to augment that with standardized tests like the SATs, SAT subject tests. I try to turn kids on to CLEP tests. You can go to community college and take some classes and then put those on your transcripts too. Anyone can write these things. I can write them because I kind of know the language and I know what colleges are looking for. But like if you're willing to put the work in, you can sit down and learn how to do it. And really anybody can do it. And colleges accept them. Like there wasn't a single college I contacted that responded to me that say they don't accept it. They absolutely accept them. And it's also something, I was cleaning up my basement and I found my high school transcript down there and it meant nothing to me. There was no connection to it whatsoever. It was a bunch of numbers and classes I don't remember taking. I could probably name two teachers I had. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if I even had them or if that was just study hall or something. So it's like I literally can't, and I didn't do drugs or anything in high school. It's not like anything like that. It's just that it was so meaningless to me.
Not memorable, right.
It's not memorable at all. Like a narrative transcript of the activities that you chose to pursue that you failed or succeeded in and that you learned something that was part of your journey through life is something that I feel like if you're cleaning out your basement and you find it 20 or 30 years later, it's going to be more meaningful to you.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, and that was the case with me. I went to a small college. It was how I got into a small college as a finger quotes underperforming high school student because they can, when you're not the University of Arizona and you're not taking, 80,000 applicants for a new year, you can look at people in a more holistic way, which I think is a nice feature of smaller institutions. Again, if people feel like college is the right path in 2018, disclaimer. So
sure.
That's great. I think we just worked together to make the high school diploma obsolete, perhaps.
Perfect. Done. Finished. My year's
done. So the final question that I wanted to ask you about this, I know this was a difficult program to get going where you are in New York, lateral to the public school system that everybody is already paying for. And most people are just, everybody's going there and there's kind of a passive acceptance of its existence, even if there are some complaints about it. But what is the future of this idea? Because even if it didn't work in a physical location where you are right now, I think it really has a lot of promise in a different venue.
Well, okay. So there's a couple things there, I guess. First of all, I think if I put it online and I have a structure there and I run it free of charge, maybe donations or whatever, and I can help kind of walk people through it or walk parents through it, I think maybe I can reach a broader audience while still maintaining much of the bones of what it is I'm proposing here. Also, the website is there. You go to brianhusky.com. Like, you could look through all of this and put a program together yourself. And feel free to message me if you need help or whatever. But like, it's all here already. The only thing you're missing in Husky's Heroes is Husky, because I won't be there. But like, you can reach out and contact me and I can help you through it. There's another thought I've had, and you mentioned my book earlier. And the second half, the first half of that, part of what you read, and then the second half of that describes what some public school might be able to do to bring something like this program into a compulsory education environment. And that is, there really isn't and again, I'm speaking with a New York lens, but there really isn't a law or a rule that says that you need to have, that school needs to be structured the way it is. There's right. a law or a rule that says that you need 4 credits of English and 3 credits of math and 2, whatever it is, right? There is a regulation of that, but how you receive those credits is really up to the Board of Education more than anything. I'm hoping that my book gets into the right hands and people read it and people think it's a good idea and people start trying to implement some of these. And I actually lay it out in the second half how you could specifically do that. If you're going to have trust. Like, the Board of Ed is going to have to trust the administrators, and the administrators are going to have to trust the teachers. But if that foundation is there, and if they're willing and they talk about it, and if they implement even a sliver of some of this self-directed stuff in a compulsory setting, it would be, you know, it's not like you said, the push the button thing. It's not like the push the button scenario that I would like, but it's one step closer. And I think it would really benefit kids. I think teachers would be happier. That's half the reason I started this program too. I want to show schools that, look, this is possible. You can run a ship like this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's a great idea. And I hope that this discussion here can just be the beginning of, you know, you getting ideas on this. From people in my audience, there's obviously a high level of interest in this pursuit there. I'm invested in this idea, and I actually hope that this could be the first of several conversations, considering that I wrote an outline for this show and only looked at it once. There was a lot of stuff that we didn't cover. And, you know, I read the first 2 chapters of your book the hour before the interview began. I'd like to continue to do that until I'm done, and maybe you could come back in a month and we could talk more, because this was a really great conversation, Brian, and I appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate you putting all of this information online, and I'm impressed by these efforts, and I really hope they find success.
Well, I really appreciate that, and thank you for having me on, and I would love to be on again.
My pleasure.